Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When it comes to business and the economy, this year's been full of turkeys. From a roiling stock market to high unemployment and a housing bust that won't quit. So it's a relief and perhaps a necessity to set aside at least this one day to be thankful. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday. It is the 26th day of November. Happy Thanksgiving. Wall Street and Washington may be in a post-prandial stupor today, but it is not a holiday in China. And Beijing is making news ahead of the big climate summit in Copenhagen, Denmark, a week from Monday. Today, the Chinese government announced it will cut its greenhouse gas emissions by 2020. Well, cut the growth of its greenhouse gas emissions anyway. According to the state news agency, the pledge is to reduce what's called carbon intensity. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson cuts through the jargon for us.
Carbon intensity is the amount of carbon emitted per unit of growth in gross domestic product. In other words, China will still be able to grow its economy, and emissions will still go up even as it meets its new carbon targets. Emissions just won't increase as fast as they do now.
I think it's for real, but it's not everything that's needed.
Dan Esty directs the Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy.
The real goal, of course, is hard targets that are in place without regard to how much economic growth there is. And the United States ultimately needs to do the same. But to have both the United States and China, the two biggest emitters of greenhouse gases, now committed to action on climate change is a dramatic step forward and should be celebrated.
The Chinese commitment comes just a day after President Obama announced he'll go to Copenhagen. He pledged the U.S. will cut its greenhouse gas emissions by about 17% of 2005 levels over the next decade. Mark Nichols is editor at Environmental Finance magazine in London. He says the real impact of the Chinese announcement is that it may lead to a deal in Copenhagen.
It's not a huge concession by the Chinese. They should be able to meet these targets quite comfortably. But it will help to unblock the negotiations and move things forward.
That's something Nichols says could provide an economic benefit to China, which is hoping to become a global leader in developing low-carbon technologies. Still, Nichols says whatever deal does emerge from the climate summit won't be anything close to what many scientists were hoping for. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Today in London, a British high court ordered Liberia to pay millions of dollars to two offshore investment firms. The firms run so-called vulture funds, and they had sued the impoverished West African country for an unpaid debt dating back to the 1970s. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The two funds are registered in Caribbean tax havens and run by unnamed financiers. They recently bought some debt that Liberia had defaulted on years ago, and then they sued the country for repayment. They're demanding $20 million, including interest and penalties. That's more than three times the original sum borrowed. Today, the British High Court ordered Liberia to pay up. Jonathan Stevenson of the Jubilee Debt Campaign.
Liberia is one of the poorest countries in the world. It doesn't have enough money for health and education for its own people. It's outrageous that $20 million of Liberia's money could be lining the pockets of vulture funds based in tax havens.
Outrageous, he says, but not surprising. He claims that over the past 5 years, vulture funds have extracted almost $1 billion from poor countries like Liberia, Zambia and Congo. A member of the British Parliament, Sally Keeble, is now pressing for a change in the law. She wants to curb what she calls the vulture fund's extortionate profits.
What I'd like to see is very clear restrictions on the amount that the vulture funds can recoup, particularly from the heavily indebted poor countries, so that they're only allowed to recoup the debt that they've actually bought.
She says she doesn't want to restrict the general and legitimate trade in second-hand debt. After today's court hearing, the Liberian government denounced the judgment as patently unjust and said it may appeal. The lawyer representing the two investment firms refused to comment. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Investors are gorging themselves on stuffing instead of stocks today, but the rest of the world was open for business, so we'll have details on the international markets when we do the numbers. I don't know what you're drinking today, but I love a good earthy Pinot Noir with my turkey dinner. Of course, we've also got a bottle of traditional Beaujolais Nouveau for the table. Winemakers have long argued their business is recession-proof, but this downturn has tested that theory. So winemakers are working to find new buyers, including one market the industry had previously written off. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, Ethan Lindsay reports.
Matt Maloney is a 34-year-old landscaper in Bend, Oregon. On a warm summer evening, he's sipping a beer in a patio bar.
I do like wine, but I drink beer. Wine, I think, has this, maybe not stigma, but some sort of something attached to it that makes it a little more formal instead of social.
Men, on average, say they prefer beer to wine, according to a Gallup poll last year. Industry research shows that women make up 70% of wine buyers. Winemakers are trying to change that. Ted Farthing is the executive director of the Oregon Wine Board.
We're all fighting for share of stomach.
Now winemakers across the country hope to make wine more masculine. Chris Justema is the co-owner of another Bend brewery and bar, Cascade Lakes Brewing. He says wine is more of a dinner party beverage than something to drink while hanging around with the boys.
You know, it's cool for guys to sit around and drink a bottle of wine. Let's not get away from it. But most guys I know at least start with a few beers and then move to a glass of wine at dinner.
Some well-known winemakers have even crafted labels and names specifically for men. Names like Kung Fu Girl, Red Truck, and Maximus. Others are advertising in sports known to attract men. For instance, Sonoma County's Bennett Lane Winery bought a NASCAR racing team and just sponsored a minor league NASCAR race. Just 30 minutes north of Cascade Lakes Brewing, Marigas Winery hosts tasting and jazz shows. Owner Doug Marigas says sports and cars aren't the only ways to appeal to men.
Most men are going to like either red wine or a slightly sweet white wine. Just what I've seen. I'm not saying that I actually make it thinking, how can I attract men?
The secret? Just to make good wine. In Bend, Oregon, I'm Ethan Lindsay for Marketplace.
I've talked before about how frugal chic has taken hold of this nation. Seems you're a better person these days if you make your own clothes and cobble the soles of your own shoes. But we wonder just how much you actually save with DIY everything. Well, Jennifer Reese has done some of the math. The former book reviewer for Entertainment Weekly lost her job a few months ago. Now she's a blogger channeling Betty Crocker and trying to determine what that does to her bottom line. I drove to Reese's home just north of the Golden Gate Bridge, and the smell of yeast wafted through the air before I even reached the door.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Tess.
Oh, hi. I was like
reading
over my
story.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet
you, too.
These days, Reese is a backyard apiarist who also raises chickens and makes all kind of food and drink from scratch.
A glass of water or a cup of tea or anything? Well, do you have anything homemade?
No.
No? No homemade root beer or whiskey or anything like that?
No. Oh, actually, I do.
She offered me some Cherry Bounce, a concoction of cherries and bourbon that's been stewing in the pantry for months. Perhaps this is why she calls herself the Tipsy Baker. We chose to stick with water for the afternoon refreshment, and Reese got started punching holes in blobs of dough on the kitchen counter.
Look at these. These are big, gnarly bagels. They're sort of beautiful in their rough way.
They look homemade.
They look homemade.
As she plopped them into boiling water, Reese noted that when she started doing all this happy homemaker stuff, she wasn't sure about its cost effectiveness. So she checked what a single bagel from the grocery would cost. 45 cents. At the national bagel chain Noah's, 75 cents. Here in Tipsy Bakerland, a winning 15 cents a bagel. But not every frugal food effort is paying off so promptly. We headed out back to what we'll call Reese's Urban Livestock Center.
Hey, girls, where are you? Come here. Come here. See, we have 12 chickens. They were about $3 each to buy. And they have been incredibly cheap.
And what have they given to you?
Nothing yet, but they are going to start producing eggs, I'm sure, like, you know, 60 eggs a week, I'm hoping. The cost effectiveness, we're going to about break even in terms of how much I've spent on the chickens, if they produce anything like what they're supposed to produce. But we're going to have so many more eggs than we need that if we could actually sell them, we would make a profit.
So far, the chickens cost about $175. We walked through her new veggie and fruit gardens and back upstairs to the kitchen. The now baked and browned bagels came out of a hot oven.
See, you would never mistake these for a store-bought.
No, I wouldn't, but I kind of like
that. Some of them don't even really have a hole.
Now, do you have any homemade cream cheese to go with these?
I made cream cheese, and that was not a success. It was very loose, creamy, and it just was not something anybody really wanted to eat.
And it didn't come in a block surrounded by foil.
Exactly.
So, no more homemade cream cheese. I wondered what else she'd attempted where the cost-benefit analysis didn't exactly work in her favor.
I made butter. That was really stupid. It costs more to make butter by whipping your cream than it does to buy butter. It does not make sense unless you have a cow.
Jam, however, is cost-competitive. Crackers are not. Granola isn't either, but she says it tastes so much better that it's worth the extra cost of making your own. There was, however, one bit of frugal fooding for which Reese may never recoup her investment.
Would you like to see the bees?
Oh, yes.
We walked out to a small deck with 2 3-foot-tall apiaries. I asked what had prompted her to become a suburban San Francisco beekeeper.
Well, I don't know. I had always thought about doing all these things, and I lost my job in December. And suddenly I had a lot of time, and I started thinking about my little piece of land and what I could do.
And that naturally led her to a beekeeping seminar.
It's an extremely expensive hobby.
What was your initial investment here?
I have spent $1,000.
$1,000?
Yeah. 2 beehives with the bees and the books and the smokers. And that is not, I mean, I was not extravagant.
All right, well then let's ask what you've gotten for your investment?
Nothing.
Nothing? Yet?
Nothing yet. Conceivably, if these hives produce what beehives can produce average in the San Francisco Bay Area, you could get about $350 a year, but I would have to sell the honey and bottle it. And that is.
And are you planning to do that?
No.
No?
But who knows?
But really, she said, as we returned to the kitchen, efforts like these can't just be about pinching pennies. Reese says when she first started tabulating her costs,
I assumed that it was ridiculous and that it was going to be, of course it was going to be cheaper to buy your own yogurt. I thought everything everyone did in a factory was going to be cheaper. And it was sort of this fake economy around being crunchy and homespun. But it actually turns out to be almost true that you can save money by doing things at home.
So how much of this is to save money? None. And how much of it is something else?
I don't know if I think it's about that. The chicken coops and the bees are about frugality. I think that if you say that you're doing it to be frugal, that's probably not rational.
And with that, it was finally time to partake of the Tipsy Baker's bagels.
Well, I think they're tasty.
They're tasty.
And they actually have a little more crunch on the outside than normal bagels do, and I like that. Mm-hmm. So how often do you make these?
I've made these maybe 6 or 7 times. My kids love them. I made the first batch I made. They ate them all in like an hour.
All right. Well, we're going to put up this recipe on our website and invite folks to make bagels right along with you and see how that process goes. Jennifer, thanks so much for inviting me into your home and feeding me.
Oh, thank you.
That was Jennifer Reese, also known as the Tipsy Baker. Check out our website for a veritable buffet of photos and recipes. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, food pantries receive a sweet treat that's also good for you.
Having the opportunity to distribute 8,000 or 10,000 pounds of oranges, I mean, it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing.
But first, let's do the numbers. Markets in the U.S. were closed for the Thanksgiving holiday today, but overseas, news that Dubai's government investment fund is struggling under billions in debt continued to rattle investors' nerves. European shares saw their biggest one-day drop since April. The French CAC 40 lost nearly 3.5%. Germany's DAX shed 3.25%. Britain's FTSE index dropped just shy of 3.2%. The U.S. dollar fell to a 14-year low against the Japanese yen before rebounding in European trading. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Our icon on your iPhone. The Marketplace app gives you the latest in business news, plus the Marketplace whiteboards and the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org.
For the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday, November 27th. The holiday shopping season kicks off early on Black Friday as shoppers flood stores looking for the best deals. StoryCorps sponsors the second annual National Day of Listening, when Americans are encouraged to record intimate conversations with loved ones. And 85 years ago, the first ever Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade hit the streets of New York City. I'm Timothy Beckworth.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Here in L.A., we are not known so much for turkeys as tacos. And for our taco trucks, big wagons from which some of the best Mexican food in town is served. Well, last Thanksgiving, L.A.'s Kogi food truck started trolling the city's streets, serving tacos stuffed with Korean barbecue. They are awesomely delicious. And the concept became so popular, it kicked off a nationwide food truck craze. Brendan Francis Newnham caught up with Kogi back in January, just as interest was heating up.
What are you guys eating?
I'm eating the Kogi, the
Korean beef taco.
It's so good that I forgot what it was called, you know?
I'm Korean and I love Mexican food, so this is perfect for me.
I was kind of worried at first because I thought it might just be like Korean food in tortillas. And I was like, but then I tasted it, and it's like way more. It's like way good.
I was just walking down the street, and I saw a long line for a taco truck, which is something you don't see very often. And I asked somebody in line, what would this many people stand in line for? And he said, Korean barbecue, and it will change your life.
Can I get your full name?
Mark Mangera.
What is your title here at Kogi?
Oh, boy, I guess I'm the founding father of Kogi.
And when did you find it?
I was out with my sister-in-law. We went out. Of course, we got drunk and everything. We came home, and I live in Korea. I'm Filipino, and I married into a Korean family.
Oh, okay.
So I said, wouldn't it be great if someone put Korean barbecue meat in a warm corn tortilla?
It's outrageous. It's so simple, but it's mind-blowing.
You're absolutely right. It's a perfect marriage of the society that we live in every single day. We live in a Latino Hispanic community, and Korean barbecue and Korean food is so unplayed. Right now, everyone knows Japanese food as teriyaki. Everyone knows Chinese food as sweet and sour pork. But no one knows Korean barbecue.
People who don't understand Korean barbecue, can you just describe to them what makes it special?
Korean barbecue is basically a simple marinade of soy sauce, ginger, scallions, a little bit of sugar, a little bit of all these Asian basic ingredients. marinated for 24 to 40 hours, cooked on a grill. It's a done deal.
Hey, thanks so much for chatting with me.
Of course, my pleasure.
What are you guys eating over there?
I think I'm eating a chicken taco.
What do you think about the prices?
Well, I mean, after they make you wait an hour, you're willing to pay just about everything.
Well, you figure probably two blocks that way, crack is $5. $2 for a beef taco is not so bad.
But my new fix is beef tacos.
That's reporter Brendan Newnham with a piece that originally aired on the public radio podcast Dinner Party Download. You can feast on more at dinnerpartydownload.com. American consumption tripled in just the last 20 years, and although the recession did put the brakes on the buying binge, we still spend a lot of money on everything from cars to toys to food. And with all the food choices available, organics, fast food, you gotta wonder how our demand is supplied. Marketplace's Steve Henn considers some hidden costs of our collective gluttony.
My wife and I splurge on organic food for our kids. Our three girls drink 6 gallons of milk a week. We have fresh fruit on our kitchen counter every day of the year.
Would you like a banana?
And every morning there's a feeding frenzy in my kitchen.
Mom, I need a spoon.
This insanity usually starts before my first cup of coffee.
I'm eating cereal right now.
It often ends with me scraping soggy bits of organic mango cereal out from underneath the kitchen table. But this morning was a bit different. I decided to track down every bite my kids ate and figure out where it came from. Within a week, I realized our simple breakfast had traveled the globe. By truck, train, ship, and even refrigerated jet plane. In fact, each bite of that hippy-dippy mango cereal traveled more than 6,000 miles before it ended up on my kitchen floor. This would have been unimaginable when I was growing up. Brian Hallweil is at the World Watch Institute and author of Eat Here.
In the United States, the average food item is now traveling about 1,500 miles from the farm to our plates. That's about 20% farther than two decades ago.
My kids' cereal's packaged in Oregon. The oats come from Canada, the mango from Mexico, and spices are shipped in from farms around the world. Our kids' yogurt, cultured in California. Our milk, bottled in Pennsylvania. But really, what's wrong with that?
Shipping food around the planet gobbles up a tremendous amount of energy.
In 2000, it gobbled up the equivalent of 242 million barrels of oil. That's more than 10% of total U.S. oil production. Food shipping alone spewed more than 200 billion pounds of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And transportation's just the half of it. Much of this food has to be refrigerated every step of the way. At the Port of Philadelphia in the height of summer, 40-foot refrigerated containers are piled high above my head, each plugged into a thick electrical cable. They're full of frozen beef. It's 95 degrees on the docks, but inside those containers it's ice cold. America's already the largest beef producer in the world, so why all this bother? Joe Menta is the spokesman for the Port of Philadelphia.
And it's kind of funny, you need the Australian beef, the New Zealand beef, cut into the American beef to get the fat content down enough so it can be permitted to be sold in American fast food restaurants like McDonald's and Burger King.
That's right. Trimmings from grain-fed American beef are too fatty to meet federal health regulations for hamburgers.
It's a perfect example of this sort of absurd, wasteful food shipping.
Instead of putting American cows on a diet, we ship frozen beef more than 12,000 miles by sea in refrigerated boxes. Every way you measure it, the numbers are staggering. Today, we import 33% more food than we did just 7 years ago. From coffee to grains and fruit.
Mango cereal.
No.
More.
And the rest of the world is catching up. Global food shipping has increased almost 50% this decade. Hallweil and others believe this system's unsustainable. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Food pantries across the country are seeing record demand for their services. More and more families need help just getting by. Pair that with the drop in donations, and many food pantries are worried about being able to meet the need. Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll reports that instead of giving money, some groups are donating the fruits of their labor.
Hi, guys. Come on up. We're about to do a quick orientation.
A group of about 20 volunteers carrying ladders and baskets surrounds Rick Nemias, the organizer of an afternoon event called the Big Pick. They're gathering on a driveway next to a sprawling house. Behind them is a private grove of orange trees. It'll take just a few hours for these volunteers to harvest thousands of oranges.
This began as a neighborhood project. I'd actually get on my bike and I'd see someone with a tree and I'd stop and talk to them and said, hey, this is what we're doing. Would you be interested in letting us use your tree?
And if they were, Nemias would show up with volunteers and pick the tree clean. The group donates all the fruit to a food pantry with three locations in Los Angeles. The pantry's director of operations, Fred Summers, says this idea couldn't have come at a better time. The pantry's seen demand rise 40% over the last year.
So having the opportunity to distribute 8,000 or 10,000 pounds of oranges, I mean, it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing.
This helps the food pantry cut back its spending on fresh produce. Instead, the money will go toward milk, peanut butter, tuna, other staples. And oranges are packed full of vitamins.
Many of the people that we see who are living on low incomes have very poor diets. Not just that they don't have enough food, but they're eating the wrong foods.
The owners of the trees benefit too. When the fruit doesn't get picked, it rots and attracts coyotes and other critters.
Hello, hello.
Homeowner Grant Goshen greets volunteers before they head out to a small orange grove. Goshen says this is a simple way to give back. And as a banker at UBS, he sees the need every day.
I see it. I live it. I'm seeing the devastation out there, and it's horrendous.
That sentiment is motivating more volunteers as well. Fruit-picking groups from California to New York use online forums like Craigslist, Twitter, and Facebook to find each other. Big Pick volunteer Emily Dell says the idea appealed to her immediately. She can help others, and it's not a bad way to spend an afternoon.
You're up there surrounded by the blossoms, smells beautiful, and the tree kind of is holding you, and you're grabbing the oranges. It's wonderful.
In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
To see what an orange tree picked clean looks like, you can check out Caitlin's pictures. They're on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, earlier in the numbers we mentioned that London's FTSE stock index fell about 3% today. It also stumbled for about 3 hours. A technical outage forced the London Stock Exchange to shut down trading for part of the day. It's the second time in a month that trading had to be suspended because of, quote, connectivity issues. Just yesterday, the head of the exchange outlined plans to outfit the LSE with new and faster technology. Maybe one of those toy hamsters got into the wiring. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. The markets were closed for the Thanksgiving holiday today. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. On Black Friday tomorrow, where, oh, where is Liz Claiborne? Brand names moving to new stores on tomorrow's Marketplace Morning Report. And next time on this program, protesters line Chicago streets to show their love for a bank.
Too good to fail. Park National Bank. Too good to fail.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you're having a great holiday.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.